From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's not like the wolf is the only apex predator competing with humans in the West. Grizzly bears will kill livestock and big game. Cougars will too. But for some reason, the wolf inspires a special kind of hatred. Here's how wolf activist Kent Weber describes it in a new documentary produced for the public TV station KUED.
It's the only species that splits your mind in half. One side is absolute fear, and the other side's admiration. So everybody has something to say about a wolf.
Today in the program, we're talking about wolves. It's been 20 years now since the animals were reintroduced back into the Yellowstone ecosystem, and the controversy surrounding them has not faded. We'll talk about it after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The relationship between humans and wolves in the American West is complicated for sure. Our role on the ecosystem, the wolf's role, plays out in these Byzantine layers of cause and effect. But when you really boil it down, the reason wolves have been controversial in the West as long as we've been around as a species is competition. Competition over meat, mostly. Wolves kill livestock and they kill big game. And so do we. But humans have had the upper hand for most of the history of the West. Wolves were decimated as a species decades ago. But then came 1995, and the predators were reintroduced into Yellowstone in Idaho. In his new documentary film about wolves, producer John Howe says, some see that moment as one of this country's most significant natural history events. And it's been nearly 20 years now since that, but the controversy over wolves has not faded. Today in the program, we're going to ask why. We'll profile John Howe's new film and examine how the return of the wolves to the West is playing out. We invite you to join us. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. John Howe is with us here in the studio, film producer at KUED. He's produced several documentary films about wolves in the West. His new film, his latest, is called Return of the Wolves, The Next Chapter. It airs on Monday night. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. But John Howe, welcome back. Thanks for being
with
us.
Thank you.
David Moskowitz is also joining us. He's a professional wildlife tracker, photographer, and writer. His book is called Wolves in the Land of Salmon, and he's joining us today from a studio in Seattle. And David Moskowitz, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Well, I want to begin with, a fairly broad question. And David Moskowitz, I guess I'll put this to you first. How do you explain, why is the feeling, and this is something that comes through in John Howe's film, in all of the films where he's talked about this, there's a kind of intensity that seems particular to wolves. There are other predators, other apex predators that compete with humans, but for some reason there's this sense of intensity about wolves. Do you have a hunch as to why that is?
One possibility is that we're very similar to wolves, and in a lot of ways that we're not similar to other large carnivores in this landscape. Wolves are a very social animal. They define their lives in relationship to other wolves, and that's very similar to us as humans as well. We're a very social species. And so I think that similarity puts us in relationship to wolves in a way that maybe is different than bears that are a bit more solitary, mountain lions, which are very solitary. And so that's, you know, when you're more closely related or you behave in a way that's similar to your neighbor, it just kind of makes you more aware of them, I think is probably a big part of what's going on there.
John Howe, you've been looking at this issue for a long time now. Are you closer to understanding why the intensity?
Well, I think in a way, maybe. We've been on this story for probably a good 20 years, at least since the first talks about reintroduction. And it's always been a very heated discussion. And a lot of the things, I think, sometimes there's some of the stories going back to the stories like Little Red Riding Hood and werewolves and skinwalkers and things like that have kind of put a value on wolves that the other animals really have never seen. Because wolves are top predators, but they're not that much different, at least in theory, than African lions and cheetahs and tigers and mountain lions and grizzlies and things like that. But they seem to have taken on a connotation that is a lot different for some reason. I think some of it is probably exactly as was described, that they are very similar to humans in some ways, very social. Mm-hmm. And I guess some see them as very strong competitors. Yeah. Depending on where you sit on the landscape. But this whole cultural divide issue has been very interesting, and it's made for a lot of really great drama in terms of a film.
You know, one of the things, David Moskowitz, that John Howe points out in the film is that wolves have evolved with humans, I guess in some ways alongside, it could be said. Does that help describe our relationship with them? Again, you mentioned that kind of similarity, but if we've been with them kind of from the beginning, maybe that gives us another clue as to why there's that sense of intensity.
Yeah, well, all over the Northern Hemisphere, humans have been living alongside wolves and being in relationship to them. And if you look at our origins as a species, again, just coming back to these similarities, we were probably scavenging carcasses that were produced by much larger carnivores than either ourselves or wolves, like with wolves right next door doing the same thing. And we've also been learning how to kill large animals that we're not really evolved biologically to do. You know, we've had to learn how to do that socially. And wolves are kind of the same way. They actually were more omnivorous in their evolutionary history, and they've had to basically re-evolve in towards a more specific carnivore of large ungulates. So humans and wolves have been on this kind of same trajectory for a while now. And then the other piece, because we both live in such diverse landscapes all over the Northern Hemisphere and, of course, the world for humans as well, that we're very adaptable to different environments. We do a really good job of altering our behavior and even our social structure to figure out how to utilize the resources we find in a new or different landscape. And as humans have been doing that, wolves have been doing that right alongside us humans for a long, long time.
You know, you point out in your book, David Moskowitz, that Native American cultures have a kind of an abiding respect or have for wolves. But then Europeans arrive here, of course, and you say they arrive with this symbol that John Howe mentions, of course, very different symbol. The European wolf was a symbol of evil, an icon, you put it in your book, of a cruel and heartless killer. But I wanted to kind of work through that a little bit with you because you write about this. You say very early on in Europe, wolves, in fact, were kind of like regarded like Native Americans in some way. They were positive symbols. Let's not forget a wolf plays a key role in the myth about the founding of Rome, of course. So early on, we see them as more positive figures, more positive symbols, I guess, at least early on, right?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the general idea that you just expressed about how, quote, Native Americans see wolves or, quote, Europeans see it it's a little bit broad, and this is one of the troubling points that we get into when we deal with wolves is that people like to create these kind of artificial dichotomies. And one of the realities is that people all over the world have had different relationships with wolves depending on what their material culture was like and then what their cultural history was like. So we always take a little bit of our history with us into our current economy and culture. And so that will influence how we feel now about things. But generally, human cultures tend to evolve as their lifestyles change. And so one thing that we saw in Europe and in other places in the world is that when people were making their living as hunters and gatherers, mm-hmm. They tended to see wolves as a creature that they wanted to emulate. This is a very successful hunter of large game. This is something that we as humans also want to do. And we can learn from wolves and be in relationship to them in that way. And then when that same culture shifts to a more agrarian herding livestock culture, all of a sudden their culture, their relationship with wolves changed, where now we have a sense of ownership of these food items that we didn't necessarily have in quite the same way before that. And so now wolves coming to eat our food is seen in a really different way. And even here in North America, indigenous peoples had a wide range of perspectives and in relationships to wolves. Some revered them intensely, others, you know, feared them and didn't perceive them to be this like noble species that other, you know, tribes maybe did.
Yeah. But it's about material culture, right? As soon as that became an issue, then there was conflict.
Well, there's certainly – that's a big part of it is that, you know, we have to make a living on the landscape. And as we – you know, if we perceive another part of the landscape as threatening how we're feeding our children, then all of a sudden that it would encourage us to maybe not feel as good about them as we did when before we didn't necessarily see them in quite the same way. But that's not the whole story there because humans are such – you know, cultural animals, such social animals, and we're really good at holding on to our stories from previous generations and taking that forward and having that influence where we're at. That's one of the reasons that, you know, wolves were never completely eradicated from Italy. There was such a strong cultural connection to them, even as the material culture changed to become more agrarian, based on livestock and such. They never completely got rid of their wolves. And so that's probably – it's been kind of – hypothesized that that may be in part because of that strong, you know, historical value of wolves that kind of crept into even modern day.
You point out in the book that the last actual wolf was reportedly killed in England in the early 16th century. In the rest of Europe, apart from Italy and some, I guess, some other places, they were mostly gone by about 1700. But then you write in your book that wolves had largely, despite the fact that they'd been largely eliminated from the homelands of all of these European colonizers before they came to North America, they still carried with them that symbol of the evil wolf with them here, which you say is pretty spectacular. Is that what you mean by we carry our stories with us?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. Even as the world has changed around us, we still, you know, have this desire to hold on to our lineage, and which is, I think, a wonderful part about being human and bringing those stories with us and helping that inform how we raise our children and so forth.
Let me ask you, John Howe, when, as you were talking to, and we're going to play a few clips as we go along here, one person that you talked to was a rancher and a hunting guide by the name of Martin Davis, lives north of the Yellowstone park and system there. He hunts. He makes his living as a rancher. He talked about a kind of fear that they have for wolves. Doesn't have much affection for the creature, of course, but is it's fear. How do you do you sense fear from them more than hatred in some way? Are they afraid of them? How do you describe that relationship?
Well, what Martin is talking about in the film is sort of the historical context with wolves, and he puts it in the context of maybe many years ago they were after your saddle horse. And if they actually got your saddle horse, then you might not survive. So he's looking at it from that kind of a standpoint. I think there is possibly some fear, but I think a lot of it is really economic, you know, for the most part. So, but they talk about it in that kind of context and the way that their ancestors looked at wolves, and that was certainly one of the factors that played into it.
Let's talk about the reintroduction of the wolf into the Yellowstone ecosystem in 1995. John Howe, this is really the beginning of the modern-day controversy. It's interesting, in the film, I didn't realize this, but you talk about how there was a plan or there had been talk about doing this for years. In the 60s, they were talking about doing this.
Well, Ed Bangs talks about that in the film. He's with the Fish and Wildlife Service, or was. He's now retired. But evidently, there had been talks going back to the 60s about doing this. And, of course, those debates, as you know, were quite heated and contentious, and lawsuits were filed and other things. So it finally came to fruition, but it wasn't a very easy process all the way through. So Bruce Babbitt and some of the others in the film talk about that as well.
Well, I mean,
it was right in the middle of it.
Well, right up until the moment in January when it actually happened, wasn't there a question as to whether it would?
There was. Yeah, that was Bruce Babbitt's famous quote, is that if the wolves were not released, they probably would die in those crates.
Yeah.
So, and they finally were turned loose.
David Moskowitz, I wanted to ask you, how did we lose the wolves in the first place in Yellowstone? I mean, this is another thing that comes up in the film. There's a wolf watcher who talks about the original park rangers are some of the ones that killed off the original wolf populations But I think it's so strange because in some, they didn't kill off the grizzly bears. They didn't kill off the mountain lions. They killed off the wolves.
Yeah, well, they certainly did a number on all the other carnivores as well.
They tried?
Yeah, so that, you know, represents changes in not just how we kind of culturally perceive wolves and changes in terms of, you know, us having livestock as a part of our economy, but also changes in our understanding of ecology and ecosystems. And there was in Yellowstone and in other parks, there is a belief that carnivores weren't necessarily a part of a functioning natural world, that we could just get rid of them and then we'd have more of the game species that we are more of, you know, have more of an affinity for naturally, or at least people did at that time. And so the idea of removing predators from parks was kind of just a part of the standard scientific understanding of how you managed wild lands at that point. And that was aside from, you know, managing losses of livestock. But at some point, it also has to do with the fact that we kind of value elk and deer in a different way than we value wolves or bears because we eat them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So.
Which I guess seems natural. Right? I mean, we're
carnivores
too. Yeah,
I mean, it is. It's, you know, it's that's the thing that as I was doing research for my book, you start looking at the biology of wolves, and wolves actually do the same thing, you know. They pick on coyotes mercilessly because they perceive them to be a threat. And actually, coyotes eat a ton of meat that wolves kill. And so they actually are. And you know, and it's also true that wolves eat a lot of elk that people like to eat. And so there is actually a relationship here. And if you look around the world, actually, carnivores do this everywhere. And wolves sometimes are the bully, and sometimes they're the one that's getting picked on. And anywhere you go when you have carnivores sharing resources, bigger ones tend to try to discourage, kill, harass the next smallest one down on the food chain there, to try to preserve more of that resource for themselves. So, you know, wolves do it to coyotes here. We do it to wolves. If you go to the Russian Far East, Siberian tigers do it to wolves. So in places where tiger populations are resurgent, wolf populations start diminishing. It's really fascinating relationship that we have with each other.
I think that was a prevailing opinion at that time, where they thought if some of the big predators like grizzlies and wolves were decimated, then you would have more elk and deer. And, of course, that's the famous Aldo Leopold quote about the green fire. He thought for a while, and I think he's writing, I think this is in the Sand County Almanac, but he talks about killing a wolf, and he thought that it would be something that would be a good thing because there would be more deer and elk populations and things. But what he said was when he noticed the green fire in the wolf's eyes, it was dying, is that neither the wolf nor the mountain agreed with that. So I think it kind of brought him around to a different point of view.
Yeah. We'll get to the particulars of that point. In fact, when we get back from a break, John Howe is with us, produced the new documentary film Return of the Wolves, The Next Chapter. It airs Monday evening at 9 o'clock on KUED Channel 7. We've got details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We also have David Moskowitz with us, a professional wildlife tracker. He's author of the book Wolves in the Land of Salmon. You can join us if you like. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is our number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about wolves, and this question in particular. What is it exactly about wolves that is so many people in the West so passionate? There are a number of wild predators who threaten the livelihoods of ranchers and hunters in this region, but none seem to inspire the fear and anger as much as wolves. It's been almost 20 years now since wolves were reintroduced back into the Yellowstone ecosystem, but the controversy has not really faded, even though our ideas and attitudes may have changed. We invite you to join the conversation today. We're talking about the latest production from KUED Channel 7, Return of the Wolves, The Next Chapter. The film's producer, John Howe, is joining us, and David Moskowitz, also with us, a tracker of wildlife, and the writer of the book Wolves in the Land of Salmon. 801-585-WEST is the number if you'd like to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. I want to play a clip from the film, John Howe. This is Doug Smith. Put him in context. He's an important figure in the film.
Doug is. He's the Dr. Doug Smith is the leader of the Yellowstone Wolf Project. He's essentially been with the reintroduction since our efforts since the beginning. It was originally run by a gentleman by the name of Mike Phillips, but Doug was there. And then when Mike went over to the Turner Foundation, Doug took over the project. So he's been doing research on wolves probably for at least the last 18 or 20 years, and maybe even before. So he's a pretty dominant voice in the story.
One of the things he says in this clip here is that, and I want to get you to talk about this after we play it, there's a lot of myth and a lot of misinformation that plays out when you're talking about this relationship between wolves and humans in the West. Here's a clip. Here's Doug Smith. It's from John Howe's film, Return of the Wolves, the next chapter.
As soon as we stop putting information out there, the myths, the fables, the legends take over. Misinformation plagues wolves worse than fishing and hunting stories. People make up stories in the absence of solid information. And knowledge and data are power.
What is he getting at there? He's talking about that there's a lot of folk legends about wolves, and he wants to get some real information out there.
Yeah, the context of what he's talking about is he's in the film, he's doing helicopter research and darting of wolves, and which has been somewhat controversial in and of itself because some people think that hanging radio collars off wolves in a national park is not the best idea.
Yeah.
What he's basically saying is that it's very necessary. And in the film, what we do is it's basically a dialogue. We let people talk, ranchers, hunters, others, and that kind of thing. And it's sort of told in a point-counterpoint manner. And that's really the context that he thinks that research is very important for that kind of thing because the data and knowledge are really the power that counteract that kind of thing. And especially now in this sort of environment that we're in this blogosphere and all the rest of it, there's a lot of heated inflammatory dialogue. And from his standpoint, he'd like it to be scientific as much as possible.
David Moskowitz, is there a kind of a lot of folklore connected to this conflict? Misinformation, as Doug Smith puts it?
Certainly a lot of stories about wolves. And yeah, there is definitely a lot of material out there that may not be factually correct. Another piece of that, though, is that a lot of times I think the conflicts around wolves are kind of a surrogate for a larger issue. So one of the big discussion points and concerns for a lot of people in the rural West is the role of the federal government in their lives and, you know, how wolves were reintroduced into Yellowstone and central Idaho by the federal government. You know, that becomes a big part of the story that often gets lost in the conversations that people have. So you can throw as much science about the reality of wolf biology and wolf ecology at them. But if really the issue is that they don't really like how the federal government is involved in their lives, then if you can talk about wolves till the end of time and you're not going to actually address the issue at hand.
Yeah.
So I think that's one issue that sometimes you'll see with some of those stories. But certainly, I think as our society has changed, our stories have changed. We keep the old ones. We add new ones. One of the most interesting new stories about wolves, new perspectives, was kind of the idea of the benign wolf.
Yeah.
And this is kind of the perspective, maybe Never Cry Wolf, the book by Farley Mowat, played a large part in, that wolves are kind of a benign force on the landscape that preserve the health of their prey species and are totally like not at all should to be of concern for humans in terms of our safety. And while wolves aren't actually at all, aren't particularly dangerous for us as humans. I mean, they are a large carnivore designed to kill animals much bigger than us, and it's certainly appropriate to be thoughtful about our our presence around them on the landscape like we would with, dogs or anything else. But I think this perspective came from, you know, changes in our society and in terms of us perceiving people living in an urban environment and longing to have a better connection with the natural world and us realizing the limitations of the resources in the natural world and realizing how dependent we are on these services that the natural world provides, that the wolf then becomes a image of kind of intact ecosystems and this idea that these ecosystems, if we can just help them function on their own, will, you know, give us wonderful things that like clean water and clean air and that there can't really be anything wrong or bad or dangerous or scary. And so that's kind of an interesting new modern story that really comes out of a population that doesn't have much of a actual grounded experience of how things actually work in, you know, the natural world.
Well, this is an important part of your film, John. I think this idea itself, because you make this point. It's made by ranchers. It's made by hunters. And as you put it in the film, wolves are predators, and how they kill is not pretty. Mm-hmm. To talk about that part, because this is an important question, at least whether it's true or not. There's this perception that wolves are very brutal killers.
Well, you know, again, it depends on your perspective. I mean, wolves pretty much have to kill or scavenge to survive, and whether it's livestock or prey animals, and it's not necessarily always a very pretty sight when it's all over with. But I think that is really the case. You know, wolves have taken on this sort of identity that's got so many issues wrapped up in it, like the federal government that you were talking about. You know, Rocky Barker in the film from the Idaho Statesman newspapers covered that story for a long, long time. And that's one of the bites in the film that he says is that a lot of the problem was it wasn't our wolves, it was their wolves.
Yeah.
And so, but I do think in some ways you've got an animal that's right in the middle of a lot of this controversy. And as some of the people in the film say, they're basically being animals. They're very large carnivores. They behave like large carnivores. And you couldn't probably expect much different from them.
Well, no, but I think that is the thing that's so interesting. I want to get David Moskowitz on this question too. Let me play a clip. This is from another rancher. In Idaho, Jeff Sitaway plays a role in the film as well. And he talks about he mentions the losses that he's experienced. Wolves got onto his rams to the tune of something like $30,000 to $40,000. He was out. But his perspective is that a wolf kills in a way that is in some way – I don't know if he thinks it's different than other predators, but pretty brutal. Here he is from the film Return of the Wolves, the next chapter.
A wolf always hamstrings them. They always get them on the back two legs. And for some reason, wolves have taken the opportunity to kill rams if rams are in the sheep. It seems like they have a real attraction to a ram, and you know, these rams were worth about $1,000 a piece, and this was the first one that they killed in this area this year. Last year the wolves came in and killed some 31 ewe lambs that we had up in this same area, and when they hit those guard dogs, if there's a pack there, they just tear them apart. And I mean literally tear them apart.
So here's the impression, David Moskowitz, this idea that a wolf, yes, is a brutal killer. It's a predator. That's what predators do. But you get a sense from Martin Davis and some of the other ranchers and other hunters there that a wolf has a bloodlust that's different. They're not just killing to get meat. They're killing because they love to kill. David Moskowitz,
right.
Talk about that.
Yeah, so that's a common, you know, kind of part of the story that we hear about. And part of that is, you know, actually, when you look at the reality, you look at the judgments there, like what does it mean to be a, quote, brutal killer?
Yeah.
Or, you know, and there's probably, I would say, as a society, a little bit of projections going on there. If you look at the history of how humans have treated animals and how humans have treated wolves and how we as humans have treated even species that we now, you know, can, you know, care about a great deal, like bison and elk, we haven't been the most tender or ginger in our take of those animals. And so I think there's a little bit of, you know, this also, I think often happens with people is like things that we don't like about what we as a group or as an individual do, we tend to try to see that in other places in the landscape. So I think there's probably some of that that's happened with wolves. On the other hand, the reality of wolves is that they evolved to run down prey, to take them down from behind, unlike a mountain lion, which has had this steady history, evolutionary history of becoming super efficient at very quickly subduing and killing large animals, much larger than itself. Wolves don't have the same mechanical, physical resources that mountain lions do. So when they kill animals, it may not be as quick as, say, a big cat or something like that. So I think some of the, you know, in all of these stories and all of these, you know, things that people perceive to be brutal or, you know, or awful or really, you know, kind of gut-wrenching, there's evolutionary history there in terms of why it is that way or you know, what the case may be. So,
but what about indeed, to that idea that they do it for fun, that they just do it because they have a particular bloodlust?
Yeah, so I don't think there's actually any it'd be hard to prove that to be the case. There's a bit of a judgment there. I don't know how you would test that as an idea. Mm-hmm. One thing that ranchers experience is that they often will lose more they'll lose many, you know, I think that rancher talked about having multiple sheep killed and probably certainly more than that pack of wolves could have consumed at one time. And that's something that's in the literature is referred to as surplus killing. And it's far more common with livestock than it is with wild game. And typically what's happening there for wolves, this is, again, kind of just a basic biological instinct that when it's easy to kill, it behooves them to kill a lot. Because it may not always be easy to kill. So if I can kill a number of animals now, then, you know, perhaps there will be food for me to have later. With livestock, you know, usually those livestock are removed so the wolves can't return to feed on them. Yeah. But with wild game, if they surplus kill, so kill two or three elk, they will very typically come back and actually consume most of that, especially if it's lean hunting elsewhere. So that's, you know, one of those stories that, you know, it's an awful experience as a rancher to lose all those animals, and you might think, well, they just love killing, but there's probably an instinctual drive there. And the other piece that's going on is livestock have lost their capacity to defend themselves effectively, so that makes it, again, a very challenging, you know, engagement between wolves and livestock in terms of what gets triggered in wolves. And the last thing that he mentioned was the idea that they go for rams, potentially. And one thing that's also true for wolves, very similar to humans, is they're looking for a meal that's going to be safe and efficient for them. And this is, you know, I talk about this often. If you think about it, for us, you get up in the morning, you go down into your kitchen to eat breakfast, and you take the hallway and you walk down the stairs to get there. You don't climb out your window and scale down the wall and run across the street and break into your neighbor's house to eat food, because it's much more efficient for you to go to your own refrigerator. And so with wolves, if, you know, there's an easy meal there, it's, you know, there's kind of a biological drive to take it. And rams are often bigger potentially, and so there may be more food there for them. So if they're not particularly harder to kill, it would make sense that they might actually like that larger prey item.
Well, let me ask you this as we sort of transition away from livestock to big game, because this is another one of the controversies related to wolves. Would a pack of wolves – why would they? I can't imagine how this would work in a sort of biological energy sort of equation. Why would a wolf go after a trophy elk, for example, when they could get a weak cow or a weak or sick, you know, or a calf for that matter? I mean, how does it? Right. It seems that the same. You could say apply the same kind of reasoning to big game, and isn't that the argument you hear?
Yeah, so this is, again, just comes down to some really basic wildlife biology concepts, some things that we can see in our own life. And so animals that are more vulnerable for one reason or another are easier for wolves to kill or provide more of a return, maybe targeted. And so it's really easy for us to think about young animals or sick animals, animals that are malnourished or weakened, to be the focus of that. That kind of intuitively makes sense for us. But the idea that a big bull elk might be more vulnerable than, say, other, you know, segments of an elk population is not intuitively make sense. But during the rut, in the fall especially, big bulls are really focused on one thing, and that's reproduction. And they will actually take way bigger risks in terms of where they travel and the amount of attention they spend focusing on avoiding predation versus pursuing reproductive goals. And so then all of a sudden they're not being as vigilant and they become more susceptible to predation. And then the other thing that happens with big bulls is because they spend so much time in the rut devoted to reproduction, they are often malnourished when they enter into the winter. They've spent all of this energy instead of putting on fat for the winter trying to reproduce. So they go into the winter malnourished and osteoporotic because of the big antlers that they produce. So again, they may become more susceptible to predation, even though we don't think of it that way because they're like, oh, this is the big animal with horns. Of course, you know, this would be, you know, safer, but not necessarily so.
Yeah, he's got something else on his mind. 801-585 West is the number. Let's take some calls. Lindy is joining us from Salt Lake City. Lindy, welcome.
Hi, Doug. Thanks a lot. I saw the movie, and the takeaway for me was sort of sympathy for the ranchers and all these biological points about wolves as killers and what they, you know, need was kind of missing from the movie. What you got was sympathy for the guard dogs and the colt that got dragged away and, the multiple sheep, which, as I understand, are reimbursed. Ranchers are reimbursed for livestock kills if wolf predation can be proven. Yeah, we're the brutal killers. I mean, there was nothing in the movie about what we've done to wolves and animals.
Lindy, that's not true.
Well,
that's not true at all. And in fact, there's a lot in the film. Of course, we've already played Doug Smith. You hear a lot of there's a whole sequence about wolf watchers. There's a whole sequence about the wolf population.
I'm not sure what you mean. But there weren't any pictures of. There was one picture of a wolf with a trap on his leg.
There were pictures of wolves.
Lindy, I get it. It was balanced, and I didn't feel that way.
I'm not going to make the case for whether it was balanced or not, but there were pictures of wolves' hides stapled to barns. There were pictures. So I just need to make that clear, whether or not it's balanced or not.
But I would have appreciated more information about the science that has been accomplished in the last 20 years, and what we saw was, you know, wolves being sedated, and what happens to them after, you know, they're left to wake up and they've been chased down by a helicopter, you know, and burned all those calories.
Well, that's another point, John Howe. I'll let you speak to that as well. But again, the whole thing
of a bunch of sheep being killed, like your author just said. You know, it's like a person being in a candy shop. Of course they're going to kill the sheep because the sheep have no defense. And, you know, it's bounty for them.
Right. Well, I think that's the point John Howe and David Moskowitz made.
I thought that there wasn't enough in the film about wolves as a biological creature, you know.
John Howe, you want to respond to that?
My takeaway was that they're brutal killers, and I don't believe that.
Yeah. So. John, I don't think you believe that either. That was not the takeaway I got from the film at all.
I mean, it's kind of an interesting thing because we rarely get that kind of perspective. Usually it's the other way around, is that you haven't been on the side of the ranchers and the hunters and others. You're on the side of the wolves and the environment and the wilderness and things like that. It's kind of rare. But as I was saying earlier on, what we really tried to do is bring in what we hoped was the best science and the best education and then have sort of a dialogue about that. And I hope that was the case. You know, to her point, I think what happens with wolves and livestock a lot of times is just opportunistic. It may be a ram. It may be a younger animal or something like that. But that's usually what the biologists will tell you. It's not so much, a feeding frenzy or some of those kinds of things. I mean, to her point, what we actually allowed people to do was talk in the film, and then usually those kind of things were rebutted because the things like the genetics of wolves and other things, there's a lot of stories out there, and that's from, you know, whether the Canadian wolf is a different species, for example, or things like that.
Yeah.
So – You know, most of the people have thought that have seen it. You know, we had a pretty big screening last Friday. Most of the people thought it was pretty well balanced, and I hope that's the case. That was really what we were trying to do. But it's, you know, to her point, it's a real challenge as well. Yeah. You know, when you got an hour to tell a very complex story, especially on things like that, it can become very daunting. And especially with, you know, like she's mentioned, the research and things like that, that is controversial. And it's, you know, what happens to the wolves usually is that they wake up and they're fine, but that's not always the case.
Right. Well, I don't want to defend your film to this caller, by the way. I just wanted to point out that there were disturbing images of wolves being mistreated by human beings.
And honestly, that's a dilemma, because there are really disturbing images out there. We used one of them that I thought was one of the most famous, and that's the wolf in the trap. And that photo went viral in a very short period of time, and there was a lot of different perspectives on that, depending on where you sit on the cultural divide there. But it's kind of symbolic of the story in a lot of ways, and it's much of what the color is talking about.
David Moskowitz, what do you make of that? I mean, there's this kind of give and take. Anytime you approach this story, there's going to be a perspective from people who see it, certainly who encounter your book. I imagine the same kind of thing, that you were too pro-rancher, that you were too pro-conservationist. Do you want to weigh in on all of this?
I think for me, as I did the research for the book and have met people all over the Pacific Northwest that are involved with wolves in one way or another, I realized that actually the story's quite a bit more complex for individuals than the way the media often presents it. And individuals have a wide variety of relationships with wolves and perspectives about wolves. And some of that's influenced by culture. Some of it's influenced by their own experience. For me, approaching that, I worked really hard to just kind of try to understand the perspective of the person that was sharing that information with me and see it from the context that they experienced the world. And it often makes a lot of sense when you do that. The challenge for us as a society is how to bring all those together into one kind of cogent cultural story that directs what we're actually doing on the landscape. And this is one of the struggles that I think people have, is that some people want to highly manage wolves or remove them or have them in, you know, really small numbers. Other people have this perspective that we should just let them, quote unquote, run wild on the landscape, and that humans should just kind of step out of that. But the reality of it is, because we make our living in the same places that wolves make their living, because we, you know, modulate elk populations for hunting goals, because we use, you know, open lands for livestock ranching, because we harvest salmon that wolves eat on the, you know, northwest coast, and we use those same salmon-bearing streams that wolves love to use. Like, we're always in relationship with wolves, and we're always influencing the landscape that wolves and other wildlife live in. So we have to actively be engaged with wolves one way or another.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go back to the phones. David is with us in Salt Lake City. David, welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Before I get to the real point of my call, I'd like to clear up one bit of information that I keep hearing repeated, unfortunately, which is that wolves are carnivores. Of course, they're not. They're really opportunistic animals, and they're omnivores by nature, just like dogs. And I think that's a really important point, because they are so opportunistic. A lot of what they feed on is the small, you know, animals and such. And if they given the opportunity, they'll also, you know, sustain themselves on vegetable matter and whatever they come across that's edible to them.
I think that point was made, actually.
The main point that I want to make is that, you know, there's this idea that wolves were reintroduced, you know, to the U.S. by the federal government. Of course, they were migrating down and
Sorry.
I can finish that for him.
Because it's a point you make in the movie. Yeah,
well, I think what he's talking about is, you know, the wolves, some of the wolves were naturally migrating down into Montana.
You point this out in the film.
Yeah, 1992, exactly. And there was, you know, there was controversy there as they came in. They came in down into a little town called Browning and did some predations and other things. And there was the Magic Pack and others there. And even the wolf, sort of the lone wolf that was in Yellowstone before reintroduction, I think people are not quite sure of its origins or where it came from. But there was a lot of talk of a natural reintroduction, whether that would have happened without some help, hard to know. Yeah. But, or at what magnitude.
Well, here in the Pacific Northwest, we have definitely a much more – it's similar but even more interestingly complicated story about where wolves come from. And we also have the same passions around – these are Canadian wolves coming in. And in Washington state, we have wolves coming from – naturally dispersing from the British Columbia coast that came into the state. We had wolves that naturally dispersed from Alberta, eastern Alberta or eastern British Columbia and Alberta, the Rockies that came in, and then northwestern Montana from wolves that probably originated from natural dispersal down there. And then also wolves coming in from central Idaho from a population that was reintroduced there. But a lot of people are confused about the difference between reintroduction and natural reestablishment of populations, because wolves are just tremendous at dispersing and like really effective at dispersing long distances and setting up new populations in places where they haven't been in a long time. This is just part of their biology. And because humans had stopped persecuting wolves so heavily, and because humans had allowed game populations to increase since the early 1900s, you know, we had laid the landscape for wolves to naturally return to these landscapes, which they have done. And then we also kind of sped up that process as well through the reintroductions in Idaho and Wyoming.
Yeah. I wonder, I do want you to clear something up, David Moskowitz, because this question has come up from time to time. We've got a number of people wondering about this, and that is the contention that the wolf that was reintroduced into the Yellowstone ecosystem was taken from Canada, and it wasn't the same kind of species. It was a bigger, more aggressive species. John does deal with that, and that there is a rebuttal to that question, but I wanted you to speak to that, this idea that it's a different creature up there now.
Yeah, great. So there's a really interesting story there. And like most of these stories that have become kind of hyperbole and are at the end of the story factually incorrect, there is some nuggets of interesting biology in there. But the basic answer is that Canis lupus is the same species all over the world. So you go to the Arctic in North America, you go to the Canadian Rockies, you go to the Northwest coast, you go to Russia, you go to Germany, you go to Italy. It's the same species, Canis lupus. So that's certainly, that's quite clear and accepted, scientifically. There's been a lot of debate and changes over the years about how Canis lupus has been dealt with in terms of subspecies, and that's really where the kind of contentions came in. Was there a different subspecies in the northern United States Rockies than in the Canadian Rockies? And there's not really much evidence to support that there was any kind of significant difference between the populations in those two places. Actually, all of the kind of most modern perspectives on how to deal with genetics in wolves kind of would suggest that they were pretty similar. The whole bit about whether the quote-unquote Canadian wolves or the wolves that were reintroduced are more violent or more vicious or, eat larger animals, there's really no scientific basis for that. That's, probably factually incorrect to the best of our knowledge. However, wolves, like many other wide-ranging mammals, as they go further north, as you go further north, that same species will tend to be larger. So a moose in Washington state is on average smaller than a moose in Alaska. And a grizzly bear in Idaho is on average smaller than a grizzly bear in Alaska. And this is called Bergman's rule. It has to do with the idea that the larger you are, the better you are at conserving heat. So having more body mass helps with that. And so you would expect, it is true of wolves, as you go further north, they tend to be slightly larger. So it is plausible that the wolves that were reintroduced to Idaho and Montana were maybe like 5 to 10% bigger than what the historical wolf population is there, just kind of looking at how that typically works. That being said, the dispersal distance of wolves, which can be 500 or 1,000 miles, means that even from these distances, long distances where the wolves were relocated from, it was totally plausible that those wolves would have, their genetics would have been making their way down all the way to Idaho and Wyoming. So this was one intact population in the past. And like I said, we just kind of sped up what was happening naturally. So
I wanted to get to a question. Lynette, a caller in Bountiful, has a question. Lynette, I'm going to ask this for you because we don't have a lot of time left. And it comes up, and that is the question of, have Yellowstone elk herds declined. I mean, there seems to be a kind of a consensus. I mentioned Doug Smith. He concedes, in fact, yes, they have. And so maybe David Moskowitz and then John Howe, I want to hear you on this as well. Talk about, I guess you would expect that elk populations would decline. I mean, so this is in fact so, but maybe speak about that, but also the broader sense of the impact of wolves now in that ecosystem on all of the ecosystem.
That's a big question.
Yeah, it is, right?
To speak to the decline of elk simply, elk populations in many parts of the Northwest and the West, in some places have been in decline, other places they've been advancing, but certainly Yellowstone, central Idaho, elk populations have been declining. And that's a function of the predator-rich environment there, but then also some major changes in habitat over the decades. And the population of elk that we kind of got used to potentially in the last few decades was much higher than it probably had been historically because of large burns that had happened in many areas that supported a burgeoning elk population, specifically with wolves influencing game populations. Much of the research has showed that wolves by themselves typically can't, you know, have a huge impact on prey populations. It's more how they act in concert with other large carnivores. So essentially, if you take wolves and you have them in a population of elk, they're not going to have much of an impact on those elk. If you add mountain lions, still might not have a big impact. You add another predator, so like black bears, now you're going to start to have some impacts. You add a fourth predator, like grizzly bears, you're definitely going to have some impacts. You add a fifth predator, like humans, and now you've got the recipe for some really big impacts on game populations. But you can add or subtract any one of those carnivores, and you're going to start having more or less impacts on these game animals. So it's really about how wolves fit into a much larger story that has to do with the other carnivores they share the landscape with, and then how those environments have been changing because of fires in the past, fire suppression, habitat management, mostly by humans.
Right. And John, ecosystems, that you get at that issue in the film as well.
Yeah, Doug Smith talks about it pretty extensively in there. And he basically, just the way that it was just described, is what he, I think, would be his point of view. The elk populations have declined. The barstool biology is it's all due to wolves, but it's actually much more complicated than that with many of the factors that were just mentioned. So, and the other thing that I think is possibly happening too is that just that the elk are more dissipated. They know they're going to, it's easier to be picked off in a large herd, for example. So there's a lot of other factors at play.
Let me ask you this finally, both of you. We don't have a lot of time left, but the rancher, Jeff Sitaway, in your film, very early on, he sort of poses it this way. It's either me or them. How is this going to play out? I mean, is that the choice, or how is it? John, how are you first?
Well, I would just quote Fred Roberts in the film. It's one of the last sound bites in the film, and he basically says that it's the law of the land. Ranchers and wolves are going to have to coexist. They don't have any choice. So that's pretty much likely to be what it's going to be. I think what I would like to see is just a good discussion of the science and the data and the education and things like that. And that's what we tried to do in the film, and I hope that comes across. And we also have just about all that stuff. Now we've got just about all of these things on the internet and the web, and you can find out just about any of these points of view and more information and things on them that way. Yeah. And that's a good way to go, I think.
Yeah, David Moskowitz, less than a minute. Final words?
Yeah, I would just say that humans are constantly changing. The natural world is constantly changing. It's been changing from before we were such a dominant force in it. And so the thing that might be disappearing is how we used to live on this landscape. And so for many reasons, that's changing, and how we're going to be in relationships with wolves and how we're going to need to make our livelihoods and extract resources from the landscape is definitely going to be changing, as will the stories about it. And so it's, I think, a challenge for us to just kind of roll with it and figure out how to adapt to a landscape that's changing both biologically and culturally.
David Moskowitz. His book is Wolves in the Land of Salmon. He joined us today from a studio in Seattle. David Moskowitz, thank you very much for the time.
My pleasure.
And John Howe produced the new documentary film, It's Return of the Wolves. The next chapter airs Monday evening at 9 o'clock on KUED Channel 7. We have all the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. John, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.